Appalachian Commissioner et al. versus Huntington Commissioner of Insurance et al. Eric Jones Page, Greg Nivinco, Howard Conkle, Howard Conkle, Joseph Inwood, Appalachia.
You may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, I'm Eric Page, a Virginia lawyer, and I would like to introduce and move the admission pro hoc vice of Greg Mitchell. Mr. Mitchell is a partner in the law firm Frost, Brown, and Todd in Lexington, Kentucky. He is admitted in Kentucky and Pennsylvania, and he was admitted to practice in this proceeding below at the State Corporation Commission in an order of 2003.
All right. Mr. Mitchell, we're glad to have you.
Good morning. Thank you very much. May it please the court. I represent the appellants, which are 24 small community and regional-based hospitals located in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. These hospitals and the underlying employees and those covered under underlying policies of which these hospitals were a part have endured a long saga with regard to the insolvency of Reciprocal of America. This case takes on a little bit of background and procedure to understand the underlying facts. The issue presented to the Supreme Court in this regard is a proof of claim that was submitted for damages that were incurred by these hospitals in the determination of what the underlying assumed liabilities constitute.
What was the claim that they were defending themselves under or against?
The underlying claim was part of an assumption transaction or a novation. These hospitals were a part of two different self-insured trusts, which were assumed by Reciprocal of America back in 1997. When Reciprocal of America was placed in insolvency in 2003, a number of parties, including guarantee associations...
I guess my question is, in either the Kentucky litigation or the Virginia litigation, how are your clients defending themselves against claims as opposed to advancing theories of recovery?
The defense or the advance of the claim was in the characterization of the liability of the underlying assumption by Reciprocal of America.
Well, the conventional understanding of defending a claim is someone sues you and you defend yourself. So why is the conventional understanding too simplistic for your transaction?
Because the transaction at issue were two assumption transactions, which were constituted by master agreements. The master agreement constituted an insurance transaction by itself. That is, the ability of one insurance company, in this case two self-insureds, transferring policies or liabilities that had previously been incurred to another insurer. That was the underlying transaction. That was the underlying part of that master agreement, was an indemnification contract, which constituted the damages of which we had sought in the underlying matter before you.
I don't think you understand Justice Kelsey's question, because his question is, how were your clients defending themselves in seeking this relief from the SEC and also from the AIGA in Kentucky?
The defense was because the underlying liability claim, so let's take for instance, as part of the master agreements, the transfer would have been an injured workers' comp claim. There would have been an order issued of which the insurance company would have been responsible to pay that injured workers' claim. When the insolvency occurred, there was an attack on what constituted these transactions. Was it a policy of insurance, or was it something else? By virtue of the fact that it was a challenge that they were not contracts of insurance, the hospitals had to defend themselves with regard to the underlying workers' comp claim. So, of all those claims that had been assumed, all of those workers' comp orders, they had to institute defense of those in the characterization of what was the underlying claim.
Well, it seems like, let me throw this out to you. You can tell me whether or not I'm accurate. It seems like to me your argument, your best argument, is that the hospitals were, in essence, providing an anticipatory defense. Because if the receiver didn't pay, the employers would be liable. The hospitals were going to be liable for those workers' compensation claims.
No,
right?
So the hospitals were liable. So under
they were going to have to pay them. They were actually going to have to come out of pocket.
Yes, sir. And they did. During this period of time, they came out of pocket for hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars.
So that's what they were defending themselves
against. Absolutely, yes, sir. So when you look, it was not anticipatory, and it wasn't as the appellee stated that we were somehow voluntarily doing it. If you look at the record, back at JD 399, the guarantee associations took the position that the assumed claims, that are the claims of the hospitals that were assumed and transferred to Reciprocal of America, are not policy obligations. They were not policy holders.
Yeah, but in a typical insurance agreement, the insurer agrees to indemnify the insured for the liability that's being assumed and for the cost of defense, right?
That's correct.
But the cost of defense is your attorney's fees in defending yourself against the claim that's been insured. That doesn't include filing a deck action against the insurer to establish coverage.
But coverage had already been established. That was what the underlying claims that were assumed by Reciprocal of America had been occurred already. That was what had been transferred.
Well, is the $439,000 in legal fees and costs incurred in the actual defense of actual comp claims?
No, sir.
Then how is it a fee incurred in the defense of claims filed by others as opposed to what is, in essence, a proactive effort to establish a contractual right under a reinsurance innovation agreement?
Because if you look at the four corners of the master agreement, which incorporates by reference the indemnification agreement, it includes all reference to all damages by virtue of that assumption of the liabilities, which would include the base assumption, which was, and if you look at the underlying transactional documents that were attached to that, it was a critical part of the transaction, including letters of government approvals and consent, one issued by the Kentucky Department of Insurance and one issued by the Workers' Comp Division, one was Workers' Comp, one was Professional Liability, that agreed that when Reciprocal of America assumed these liabilities, they would be fully and completely liable for those as policyholders, as though they had issued the policies themselves. The indemnification agreement says for all damages occurring as a result of the assumed liabilities or the transactions. So it's not just the assumption of the liability in the underlying workers' comp case. We did incur some damages in regard to a workers' comp case which was getting reopened because the injured worker wasn't getting their check, which was happening. This was a very unfortunate situation where we were all scrambling. The underlying record, if you look at the underlying 239 case, when you go back, and I had a chance to go back and revisit, The commission themselves went through a number of elements which we think are absolutely on point for determination of our claim. We were defending the core essence here of which we believe the party's intention of the four corners of the master agreement as a whole, which included the assumption contract, that is assuming that these liabilities as well as the indemnification contract said that they would be responsible for all damages, not just the assumed liabilities, but for arising out of the transactions. Keep in mind that these hospitals and the members of the hospitals transferred all of their assets. These entities no longer existed. And it was a fundamental challenge that they were not constituting as policyholders of Reciprocal of America. Put in mind, outside of this case, as an assumption transaction, as an insurance contract by itself, insurance companies, as I said before, insurance companies transfer policies all the time. Without the ability to protect yourself in this instance, the issue of whether you would be treated as a policyholder and given those rights in the future would be in grave doubt and consideration.
Let me just throw this out there. Hasn't that question already been answered by the SEC? And isn't your case just one of what the indemnification agreement says? I mean, your issue in your case seems to me to come down to what the indemnification agreement says ought to be paid.
In the indemnification, as interpreted in the context of the entire master agreement in and of itself.
Correct.
Yes, sir. So as part of that, you're correct. That would be, we believe, in the four corners of the master agreement, including indemnification, that these fees should be recoverable as part of that indemnification and be treated as this agreement as a whole should be treated as a novation, which is itself an insurance contract. And as such, it should provide that indemnification to cover these claims as a claim of other policyholders arising out of an insurance contract. And if not, at least being treated as a claim that's susceptible to the estate. Thank you.
I'm Robert Perot, a member of the Virginia Bar. I appear today to introduce Joseph N. West, a member of the Bar of the State of Texas. Mr. West had previously been admitted in the Pro Hoc Vici in the State Corporation Commission, and I would move for his admission here as well. Thank you.
Hey, Mr. West, we're glad to have you here. You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I please support? I have served as legal counsel to the Deputy Receiver, a Special Deputy Receiver of Reciprocal of America since the start of the company's receivership in January of 2003. The matter before you this morning involves a simple case of contract interpretation, focusing on whether indemnity obligations under certain indemnification contracts should be read to cover the cost incurred by the appellants in bringing voluntary litigation as plaintiffs against various state guarantee associations. It is the position of the deputy receiver that such costs are not within the scope of the indemnity obligation. As the scope of the indemnification agreements extends only to cover damages, a term clearly defined in the indemnification agreement as including only those costs and obligations, liabilities, which were assumed by Reciprocal of America from the Kentucky Insurance Trust, which I will refer to this morning as CHAT and KHAT. In other words, the indemnification agreements lay out a mechanism whereby they are the assumed liabilities are essentially
the assumed liabilities of the two trusts to their policyholders. So if their policyholders were to sue the trust for insurance and they had to defend themselves, then you probably would have to have cough up a recovery for fees. Cool. But this is more like the fees of the policyholders. This is more like the fees of a party to a merger agreement suing another series of entities and seeking recovery of claims that didn't even pre-exist the merger agreement.
That is correct. I would agree. However, under the indemnification agreement, again, the scope of the indemnity obligation is limited only to those liabilities that a Reciprocal of America assumed from the insurance trust.
What do you make of, I read your brief, but I'm not sure from appellant's argument whether the appellant is saying that the merger agreement is ambiguous or not, but assuming it were ambiguous or that's been argued and it's before us, do they not get the insurance thumb on the scale in favor of the insured where there's any ways of broadening or contracting language in order to reach that end?
No, Your Honor. I do not believe they have that the agreement should be interpreted in favor of the Kentucky Hospitals in this case. In this case, the contracts themselves at issue clearly provide that the Kentucky Hospitals are third-party beneficiaries under those agreements. And as such, their rights to recovery under the documents are no greater than the rights of the parties.
The two trusts.
The two trusts, exactly. The agreement itself states that both parties participated in this drafting. They were both represented by competent, experienced legal counsels in negotiating and drafting the agreements. So in this case, I do not believe that the construction or interpretation in favor of the Kentucky hospitals is applicable in this case. As I was stating, the indemnity obligation is equivalent to the pre-merger obligations of two trusts. In this regard, if the trust, CHAT and KHAT, had no pre-merger obligation to cover the loss for recovery, then ROA has no obligation to do so under the indemnification agreement. Moreover, because there exists no circumstance under which CHAT and KHAT would have been required prior to the merger to cover these exact costs, should they have occurred at that time, the commission was correct in granting the deputy receiver's motion for summary judgment. In contrast to the interpretation proposed by the deputy receiver, the interpretation of the Kentucky hospitals seeks to trigger the indemnity obligation on the occurrence of a connection, no matter how tenuous, between the loss sought for recovery and the pre-merger obligations of CHAT and KHAT. And they would impose this indemnity obligation even in a situation where CHAT and KHAT had no such pre-merger responsibility for the loss. And this interpretation is simply not consistent with the plain meaning of the indemnification agreement, and that it doesn't require an assumption by ROA of a loss to be indemnified. Moreover, it seeks to set forth an indemnity obligation that is greater than the liability assumed. The equivalency of the indemnity obligation and the assumed liabilities is borne out by the fact that any reliance on this unlimited, limitless connection proposed by the Kentucky hospitals would lead to a situation where an insured could have a claim under the policy that was excluded under the policy, or that no coverage existed under the policy, but yet still have a right to recover from ROA under the indemnification agreement. And that result simply not contemplated by the parties.
I guess I don't understand that, because I thought the unique thing about the situation in this particular case is that it involves claims that already existed at the time that the acquisition occurred. That's what makes this a bit unique situation.
Well, those are
so that I don't see how the hypo could come into play.
Claims that already existed, that refers to the proceeding that transpired at the State Corporation Commission in the early days of the receivership, the assumed claims matter that I think our briefs refer to. The assumed claims matter did involve claims that preceded the assumption. And that was the issue between the receiver and the guarantee associations. The receiver took the position that regardless, those claims were the claims for claims with ROA. The Kentucky hospitals are direct insurers of ROA on those claims. This matter is related to a claims that arose after the merger. These claims for costs incurred in litigation during the receivership proceedings was after the merger, not before.
Well, I know when the costs were incurred, but I thought they all had to do with claims that pre-existed the acquisition. And in my mind, it was a continuation of the payment of these workers' comp claims that already existed when ROA bought out KHAT. And it was about whether or not it would continue to be paid and by whom. I thought that's what this
there,
was
there
about.
Was no dispute that Reciprocal of America was responsible for those claims.
Exactly, but then they went into receivership. Then they go in front of the SEC, and the SEC says, yeah, the receiver needs to pay these things, right?
The receiver was not disputing that. The receiver was only there to, actually on behalf of the Kentucky hospitals, seeking to have the court, the commission, confirm that position.
Correct. But then in my mind, I was thinking that they were thinking the receiver has a limited amount of money. Well, what happens when the receiver runs out of money? Well, then that's when you need KIGA to step in and pay these claims, right? Continue to pay these claims.
KIGA was responsible. They were covered claims. It was the position of the deputy receiver that they were covered claims under the Guarantee Association statute.
Right. And that's what the litigation was all about, because they were saying they were not.
Those entities.
Right.
Those entities had declined to pay them because they were pre-merger obligations, as you pointed out.
Yeah.
However, again, in this case, we're only focused on, I think, the language of the indemnification agreement, which was that the cost to be indemnified had to be assumed by ROA. ROA had to assume those that obligation from CCAT and KCAT. However, CHAT and KHAT pre-merger would have no obligation to cover these costs. As pointed out in the pleadings, the costs were not covered under the trust insurance policies.
Let me ask you,
pre-merger obligation.
Just to make sure we're all on one accord, my understanding is that the litigation, the Kentucky litigation, we'll call it concerning KIGA, had to do with KIGA paying pre-merger claims.
That is correct.
Okay. All right. I thought so. Okay.
As I stated, Your Honor, the plain meaning of the indemnification agreements is the position of the deputy receiver that these costs are not within the scope of the indemnity obligation. And because, again, there exists no circumstance under which CHAT and KHAT would have a pre-merger obligation for these costs, then ROA had no obligation to cover these costs under the indemnification. Thank you.
All right. Thank you very much. Rebuttal?
Thank you. We believe this case is really a misinterpretation of the law. When we look at the characterization of the underlying attack, back in the 239 case and in the case filed as a deck action in Kentucky against the guarantee fund, the fundamental issue was what were the assumed claims, not whether there was guarantee fund coverage. That's what the Corporation Commission found, but that is not the issue. The issue of which required litigation, both in the commission in the 239 case and in the Franklin Circuit Court in Kentucky, was what were these assumed claims? That is the benefit of the bargain of that assumption transaction, which I say again, was itself a contract of insurance. That fundamental premise gave rise then to the fact that we did not have to defend ourselves. Keep in mind, at this period of time, the guarantee funds were paying the claims because they were being treated as policyholder claims. When the issue arose that they were not policyholder claims, just like the claims that arose post-assumption, we didn't assert any defense costs for anything post-assumption. These all concern the assumed claims. And when you look at the entirety of the master agreement, it was that benefit of the bargain of that assumption transaction that ROA would be responsible for these as policyholder claims. We were forced to defend ourselves in Kentucky. We could have done it case by case by case in front of workers' comp orders. You could have imagined what that would have been like. Instead, we held the guarantee fund steady by virtue of seeking the declaratory rights action so that injured workers continue to receive their medical and indemnity claims, including disability.
The language simply says that you get your fees, quote, in defending itself against any claim, insert of, damages. It's one thing to defend yourself against a claim for damages. It's another thing to file what is, in essence, deck actions to eliminate the need to later defend yourself against claims. Why, if it was so clear what you're saying the intent of the clause was, why didn't it say that? Why did it use the restrictive, look, if you find yourself getting sued and you got to pay lawyers to defend yourself, yeah, it's covered if it's a pre-existing obligation.
But if you refer to the integration piece, which is the master agreement, and look at section 2.3 on the assumption of liabilities, it clearly says that both CHAT and KHAT and its members shall have no other further responsibility with regard to those assumed claims. But yet that was exactly what they were confronted with. They were receiving damages because now those claims for those injured workers were sending bills for medical prescriptions.
I get that. It's logical. I don't understand this. The answer to the question I asked initially is, in a typical insurance agreement, the insurer says to the insured, I'll pay for the claim. Anybody that sues you, I'll pay for it. If you hire lawyers, I'll pay for that too. But they're not saying in that kind of case, well, if you sue me when I don't pay, or if you sue someone else thinking they might pay instead of me if I go bankrupt, I'll pay for that too in terms of your fees. That's a different idea.
Yes, sir. So I understand. So if you look at the record would reflect we asked the deputy receiver to come to Kentucky to defend us. They refused. We asked the Kentucky Guarantee Association to participate in the Virginia Corporation Commission 239 so that that issue would be determined by the commission. They refused. Not only did they refuse, they said if we lost the decision of if they were policyholder claims, they would hold that against us. But that then will not still make the determination of whether they were covered claims under Kentucky law. So it's not an issue of covered claims. It was an issue of the underlying premise of were we policyholders of Reciprocal of America, of which once that answer was addressed by the commission, then the money flowed accordingly. And that's what we believe when you look at an assumption transaction in this context or any other context where blocks of business are transferred. Having an issue where the underlying policyholders or those like injured workers have to account for those, they cannot have this issue present. That's why when you look at the other courts, and in fact in the 239 case, they went to great lengths to talk about assumption transactions and what they constituted. They constituted contracts of insurance. Because it would be asthmatic to have an insurance company or a group self-insured transfer a block of business to another carrier, and the issue of whether you're a policyholder or not is questioned. That's why courts have looked at these master agreements or assumption transactions as a contract of insurance by itself. We think that's very fundamental, and of which the underlying commission in its ruling didn't take into account. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Call the next case.